You're listening to Sipping on Some Crime podcast, hosted by Aaron. This podcast covers sensitive and triggering subjects, explicit language, and mature content which may not be suitable for children. As always, all parties are innocent until proven guilty.
Covering the complicated case of Cecil Wells. Cecil Wells was born in Lynchfield, Pennsylvania on October 27, 1902. He was the son of Winfield Aaron Wells and Frances Capwell Wells. Cecil would go on to attend the public schools in Spencer, Tioga County, New York, and graduated as valedictorian of his high school class. From there, Cecil would go on to technical training school, Buffalo Automotive School in Buffalo, New York, in 1920 until he joined his father, Winfield Wells, working at the auto shop that Winfield owned in Spencer, New York. While living and working in Spencer, New York, Cecil would meet and marry Elmira Batty. Their wedding was on December 25, 1920, in Geona, New York. Cecil and Elmira would go on to have three children. Their first daughter, Phyllis Evelyn, was born December 27, 1921. Their second born, a son, Clayton Edwin, was born November 30, 1923. And their last child together, Joyce Almina, was born November 19, 1924, after Cecil and Elmira's arrival to Anchorage, Alaska. In 1924, Cecil and Elmira would venture out, leaving New York to open an automotive business in Anchorage, Alaska. In the summer of 1924, Alaska was receiving so much national publicity due to the fact that the completion of the Alaska Railroad had just happened. That's when Cecil would decide to pack up his family and they would drive across the country from New York to Seattle, Washington, and then finish their journey by steamboat, which would bring them to Seward, Alaska. Once they arrived in Seward, Alaska, they would have to take the train to Anchorage. Cecil would spend some time working with the Alaska Railroad and even join the gold rush to Valdez Creek. Unfortunately, he was unsuccessful in mining gold. After the unsuccessful gold rush trip, Cecil decided to return to Spencer, New York to help his dad with their automotive business. In 1928, Cecil was charged and served 6 months in jail for charges of adultery. He was charged in Juneau, Alaska, and served his time in Washington State in a federal prison. After being released in 1929, Cecil would go back to Anchorage and this time as an employee of Anchorage Motor Service Center. And quickly, he would form a partnership with Bob Laudermilch, a local undertaker. Bob would open a machine shop offering a winter storage garage for automobiles, and that would allow Cecil the opportunity to keep his own equipment running through the winter and provide service for customers in those months. This partnership was short-lived. It only lasted about 6 months when October 1930, Cecil would open the Wells Garage on 5th between E and F Street. 1932 through 1933, Cecil had established Wells Garage in Anchorage and for many years became the only General Motors distributor for all of Alaska. At some point between Cecil's moving from Alaska to New York back to Alaska, he and Elmina get divorced and Cecil meets and marries a woman named Nanelle. And by 1944, Nanelle is his ex-wife. In 1944, Nanelle would decide to sell the Wells Garage business in Anchorage to local investors Max Kirkpatrick, Denny Hewitt, and Jack Clausen, and Wells Garage would later become the Alaska Sales and Service of Anchorage, which still exists today. Cecil would then move to Fairbanks, where he eventually would open and establish the Wells Alaska Motors. Not only was Cecil influential in the automotive business in Alaska, but before his death, he was involved in mining, aviation, and numerous projects that had to do with the development of Alaska. At the time of his death, he was the president of All Alaskan Chamber of Commerce, director of the Bank of Fairbanks, a member of the Elks Lodge, and the road commissioner for the 4th Division. Cecil had actually pioneered a lot of firsts in the automotive industry. He was the first to bring cars to showrooms that allowed people to see what they were actually purchasing. He was the first to invest in having these cars hauled in through the highways into Alaska once the Alaska Highway was built. Unfortunately, there was a low clearance on the overhead bridge structure coming into part of Alaska, and the first delivery of vehicles were damaged as the top load of the truck, which had Cadillac limousines, had gone under the bridge and their roofs were torn off. So they lost a considerable amount of money on those first vehicles. Not only had Cecil established a major business in Alaska, but he was also very hands-on with the development and growth of Alaska. His hands were in so many projects. He was very well known around Alaska and played a huge role in its early growth and success. Diane was Cecil's fifth wife altogether. It's not super well documented, his marriages and his divorces, but it is very well documented that Diane was his fifth wife. Cecil and Diane did have other children outside their marriage, and together they had Markham, who was 4 at the time of his father's death. Diana Wells was born in Portland, Oregon, under the name Dissy Diana Baker. There's not much known about her family and how she grew up, but we do know that at the age of 16, she would marry a man named Donald Henry Walker. At this time, Diane resided in Pacific Grove, California. Diane would get married to Donald in a Mormon ceremony, and the license for their marriage would be obtained October 1, 1938. Diane would be married to Donald until their divorce was granted to him October 9, 1948. And at this time, Diane was residing in the town of Shelton, Washington. It's also noted that at this point, Diane and Donald had 2 children, Bonnie and Sandra, but the whereabouts of these children are unknown. Diane would then marry William E. Aspie in Seattle, Washington, November 16, 1948. At this point, there was no note of Sandra and Bonnie being with her. Their marriage didn't last long, not even a year, as William would file for divorce at some point in the year. At 27, shortly after Diane's divorce from William, she would marry Cecil Wells, 20 years her senior, in Fairbanks, Alaska on September 25th, 1949, using the name Shelley Diane Walker on her marriage license. From the brief information described in the Fairbanks, Alaska newspaper, the Daily News Miner, March 19, 1950, it seems like Diane was still married to William when she met Cecil, and perhaps that's why she used an alias when filing for her marriage license, but I can't verify that. Cecil and Diane were very well known in Alaska and the States because of Wells' success with business and his involvement in helping Alaska grow. Cecil was a champion of Alaska statehood and the leading figure in Alaska's Chamber of Commerce program, which was designed to entice other captains of industry to Alaska. Wells often flew on his private plane from city to city, trying to help organize with other Alaskans to use their natural resources to build a better Alaska. He really took pride in the new frontier and wanted it to grow. From the outside, Cecil and Diane's marriage looked perfect. Papers often spoke about how Diane accompanied Cecil on many of his business trips, and when they were in the public, Diane dressed to the nines, always a beauty, was always looking very lovingly at her husband Cecil, and when she spoke of him, it was nothing but kind. However, there were rumors in Fairbanks in some small social circles that Diane and Cecil had not been getting along the best lately. Those that knew the couple believed those rumors stemmed from those that knew Cecil in his previous marriages and were aware that a few of his ex-wives had accused him of domestic violence, saying that he had beaten them. His exes would say that this seemed to only occur when Cecil had too much to drink. While there were some remarks made and judgments about the couple's age difference, Other than that, the couple was well-liked and admired by many circles in Alaska. On October 17, 1953, this well-known couple in Alaska would be a household name all across the country. Cecil Wells would be murdered in his bed during an attempted robbery. That's what all the papers would report that morning. Diane had survived with severe injuries and was taken to the hospital to attend her injuries. Reporters and onlookers were on the scene by 8 a.m. that morning interviewing officers and neighbors. So many articles were generated in the next 2 days without all the information made available. October 19, 1953, Police Chief Danforth would release a statement to the newspaper saying that Diane couldn't recall much useful information on the suspects involved in her husband's murder. Diane would tell Chief Danforth that she was so startled and shocked to be awakened by two strange men in her house in the middle of the night that she didn't get a good look at their faces. Diane said she had awoken that night with this deep feeling of fear to see a man standing on the opposite side of the bed from her. While she didn't get a good look at his face or his eyes, she remembers that he was wearing a quilted jacket and that he was around medium height and well built. As far as the second intruder, she said that she was completely paralyzed by fear by bumping into him when she was running to get help. Diane says that intruder quickly put a gloved hand over her face, telling her not to scream or they would kill her. And that's when she was struck by the first pot with flowers in it. She remembers the second flower pot coming towards her face, but she doesn't remember the impact. She just remembers waking up bloodied on the floor and it being lighter in the room than before. I want to interject here because I'm always going to just report the facts, and this is a fact about trauma and what the brain does when we experience it. And I feel it's important to bring this up right here and right now, because as I continue to read through the newspaper articles, I feel like this needs to be said. We need to talk about traumatic events and what trauma does to the mind. We are still just learning how the brain experiences and protects us from trauma. So back then, I don't think we even really were familiar with the word trauma when it came to our brains. This is what can happen when we experience trauma. Trauma can shut down the episodic memory and fragment the sequence of events. The hippocampus is responsible for creating and recalling episodic memory. Trauma can prevent information like words, images, sounds from different parts of the brain from combining to make a semantic memory. A semantic memory is a conscious long-term memory for meaning, understanding, conceptual facts about the world around you. Semantic memory is one of the two main varieties of explicit conscious long-term memory, which is a memory that can be retrieved into our conscious awareness after a long delay, from several seconds to years. To put it plainly, you can experience something traumatic, and to protect you, your brain can not only black out the memories altogether, but distort and reorganize the events, people, places, sights, smell, and so much more. There are many people that think in a broad thought process that if something that awful happened to someone, they'd remember each detail. But that's simply not true. We also can't define what trauma is for someone else. Each experience is different. Understanding this is very important because a lot of victims and survivors have been accused of lying because they're unable to recall the events or to recall them in the sequence that they actually happened. And definitely in the 50s, we had no clue that this was possible, that this was even a thing. And today, it's still not widespread knowledge. Okay, let's move forward and back into the case. Chief Danforth explained in a press conference before he attended the inquest later that day, October 20th, 1953, that the investigation would be carried out in 5 stages. The first stage would be focused on collecting all the physical items at the crime scene, collecting as much information about the persons involved, and getting the facts lined up about the events that happened. The second stage would be evaluating all the information collected in the first stage. The third stage would be assigning officers to leads that they discovered during the evaluations of step 1 and step 2. The fourth stage, Chief Danforth plans to be able to prepare evidence for prosecution, which would be presented in the fifth stage. Tuesday, October 20th, 1953 would also be the first day of the inquest into the death of Cecil Wells. It began at noon, and Diane, still healing from her injuries, would be assisted to the witness chair. Diane's testimony was about 20 minutes in which she recounted the events that took place the night her husband Cecil was murdered. Diane's testimony would be followed by more testimonies from witnesses, medical examiners, and those familiar with Cecil and Diane. Reporter John J. Ryan would note that 3 days later, Diane's eyes were still black and swollen, that her jaw was puffed up, and her nose was beaten out of shape. Her lips were lacerated, and she still had bruises scattered across her face and her scalp. Through tears, Diane began to speak slowly, describing that the man who killed Cecil seemed to be very slender and tall. Diane would go on to recount the events of October 17th. She said, quote, "We came out of the late show and went back to our apartment about 11:20 p.m., and then acquaintances in the building went up in the elevator with us. There was a picture in the elevator, and the acquaintances pointed to it and said to Cecil and Diane, 'Doesn't that picture make you thirsty?'" Unquote. The picture was about deserts and no water. Diane and Cecil would arrive to their floor, and Diane said, quote, "We went into our apartment, and after we went in the door, Cecil said, 'Speaking of being thirsty,'" unquote. Diane said that's when Cecil would trail off into the kitchen. She didn't see what he did because he was out of sight, but she did know shortly after that he went to bed. Diane wasn't quite ready to go to bed, so she stayed up and went and took a pill, which she said she normally takes before going to bed. Cecil would call out to her, letting her know that it was past midnight, and ask her when she was going to come to bed. Diane told him she was reading the newspaper, but planned to come to bed in a few minutes. She doesn't know exactly what time it was when she did finally go to bed. Diane said, though, it wasn't very long that she was sleeping when she started to become sick. She had been receiving treatments under doctor's care for weeks for a stomach disorder, and she's supposed to be on a diet, but she didn't stick to it the night they went out. Diane said when she doesn't stick to her diet, she gets vomiting spells, so she got out of bed and went to the bathroom and threw up. Diane said Cecil would hear her and come into the bathroom to check on her. He would say, quote, "What's the matter, honey? That'll teach you to eat fried meat for dinner," unquote. Cecil would get Diane a pair of pajamas. She would put those on, and then her and Cecil would go back to bed. Diane said that she slept until the moment when she was awoken by a man standing by the chair, and she believes that she had to nudge Cecil twice to wake him up because she typically nudged him in the middle of the night when he snored, and he would just roll over and change positions. After the second nudge, Cecil woke up, and he asked Diane, "What's the matter?" And at that point, Diane sees the tall, slender man rush at Cecil. Diane said that's when she leapt out of bed and ran to get help. Diane says she doesn't make it very far because as she's running to the front door, she bumped right into the other man standing in her front room. She said he too was very tall, but also very heavy. Diane decided at that moment she didn't see much of a chance of getting around him. And anyway, right then, he put his arms around her and with a gloved hand covered her mouth and pulled her real tight into him. Diane said the man half spoke, half whispered, "Shut up or I'll kill you." Diane said the man then changed hands, placing the other gloved hand over her mouth. He grabbed a flower pot, swung it at her, and hit her in the head and the side of her face. At this point, she began to feel faint, but the man held her up. She saw him reaching for another flower pot, and the next thing Diane remembers is being on her knees, on the ground, bleeding, and it seemed brighter in the room, and now she was alone. Bloody and bruised, Diane would make her way to the neighbor's door and begin pounding. Alice Orwood would open the door to see Diane, with crusted dry blood on her face, bruised and battered, screaming to phone the police and to get a doctor. Within minutes, police and ambulance had arrived, and Diane said she begged them to take Cecil to the hospital. But for some reason, there was no urgency for them to do that. They wouldn't outright say that he was dead. They just kept telling Diane it was too late. Diane's face was badly beaten, and the ambulance and police wanted to get Diane to the hospital and get her some help. She kept screaming at them to help Cecil, and they eventually forced her on the stretcher, taking her out against her will to get the much-needed medical assistance at the hospital. Diane didn't want to go to the hospital. She wanted to help Cecil. So she tried calling Dr. Hagland, but he wasn't home. She started calling friends trying to get someone to come over and help, but eventually police and the ambulance made her go to the hospital. John Madsen and Marv Rom from the fire department on the ambulance shift that night said, when they arrived, Diane was beaten so severely, they phoned a doctor over right away. Dr. Donald McLean would arrive to assist the ambulance drivers with urgent care for Diane. The doctor determined Diane needed to go straight to the hospital for more care. Dr. McLean would head to the bedroom where he was able to quickly rule that Cecil had already perished. As the ambulance drivers were trying to get Diane out the door to the hospital, Diane would again plead with them and the doctor to please take her husband first because he needed more help than her. Once Diane was checked out of the hospital, investigators would again question Diane about the intruders. And she said she specifically remembered that both intruders wore jackets, not coats, and she wanted to make that very clear. She again reiterated that the man that first approached her and Cecil was very tall and slender, and that the man that beat her was also tall but fairly heavy, and she had a definite impression that the man who grabbed her was a white male. Diane was convinced that this wasn't the first time that someone had been to their home. Both Cecil and Diane had noticed little things in the weeks leading up to the 17th. One thing that Diane had pointed out was that Cecil and Diane had a picture that hung on the entry door on the adjoining unit, a door that the family never used. One day they came home and the picture was lying on the floor, indicating that someone had used that door, and when the door was open, the picture had fallen. Diane also talks about coming home one day and finding their door unlocked when she was positive they had locked it before they left. Diane told investigators that she knew that the lock on her apartment wasn't pick-proof because one day she was locked out and the local locksmith let her in under 20 seconds. Dr. Paul B. Hagland would be next on the stand to deliver the report of his medical examination of Cecil Wells. Dr. Hagland would say, based on the content of Cecil's stomach and other indications, that his death was most likely in the early morning hours of Saturday before 6 or 7 a.m. He said, based on the powder marks on Cecil Wells, that he was most likely shot from close range. Next to take the stand was a former wife of Cecil Wells, Ethel Granite. She would testify in the inquest that when she was married to Cecil Wells, he had beat her during their marriage. Ethel went on to describe that one time when Cecil had been drinking, he knocked her down in front of St. Joseph's Hospital, where she had been visiting a relative. On another occasion, Ethel said that Cecil had chased her, her mother, and his daughter around the house with a pistol in his hand. Ethel would say that Cecil was, quote, jealous type of person, unquote, who became violent on occasion and especially when he was drinking. The physician that attended the crime scene, Dr. McLean, would testify that Cecil was already dead upon his arrival, but that blood was still flowing from the wound and that his hands were slightly colder than normal. This testimony would later be refuted by Chief Danforth, claiming that Cecil's hands were cold with a pale pallor of death setting in and the wound had already coagulated. Chief Danforth would also testify in his opinion upon arrival at the scene that Diane was not hysterical. He said she wasn't screaming or crying or shouting, which is typically, in his mind, associated with hysteria. Chief Danforth would also describe Diane's state when she arrived as agitated. He would say it was the only word he could use to describe this, in his opinion, what state of mind Diane was in when he arrived. Chief Danforth would also go on to explain that Diane also smelled of alcohol and that they didn't see any foreign matter or dirt on her face or her body. The dirt that would normally be associated with flower pots wasn't present at the scene. However, on the afternoon of October 17, 1953, Chief Danforth would tell the Fairbanks Daily News that when he arrived on the scene that morning, the police found smashed flower pots, dirt, and broken flowers on the floor, and that was the only sign of the struggle that he saw. He also noted that there was dried blood trailed to the door and hallway, which he believed belonged to Diane and was from when she was crawling to get help from her neighbors. Chief Danforth would also tell the local papers that afternoon that he didn't believe the motive was robbery, even with Cecil's wallet found empty in the hallway, because there were still too many valuables remaining in the house that they could have taken. In total, 18 witnesses were called to testify for the inquest, to include three that were asked to come back and testify for a second time. Diane, Chief Danforth, and Alice Orchwood would all be back the following day for more testimonies. At one point during the inquest, juror Joe Simon asked that the courtroom be cleared of spectators, but his request was denied by Ladessa Nordale, who was conducting the inquest. This was the murder of a very powerful, influential man in Alaska that at the time really was the last frontier, as it still wasn't a state yet. Alaska wouldn't be granted statehood until January 3, 1959. This was highly publicized and sensationalized case not only in Fairbanks, but throughout all of the United States. Alaska was still such a mystery and a strange, dangerous venture to people back then, so to have the murder of this man who was well known as someone conquering Alaska successfully and had a well-off family in the States, it created a media frenzy that would swarm the lives of not only Diane, but anyone close to her. I just want you all to understand the amount of spectators that were attending these inquests and court dates, and why this juror felt so overwhelmed by their presence. Cecil's funeral would be held Wednesday, October 21st, 1953 at 2:30 p.m. Cecil's services were held at the Fairbanks Memorial Chapel. Viewing began at 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. for the general public, 1 p.m. to 1:30 p.m. for the employees of Wells Alaska Motors, and then private services for the family. Cecil was flown to Anchorage after the services, where he would finally be laid to rest. The district attorney at the time, Ted Stevens, and if you're from or lived in Alaska at some point, you know the name because it's on everything. Stevens decided at the time to take action against Chief Danforth and force them to work with federal officers to take part in the Wells investigation. Stevens said at this point, the city police chief and his team had been solely the ones handling the case, and they had not reached out to the marshals or territorial officers to help with the investigation. Stevens said that under the federal law, officials did have jurisdiction to be involved in the Wells case. During the initial investigation, it was discovered that Diane was missing jewelry. She reported it right away. Most of it was costume jewelry, but there was one red precious stone in a heart shape that was missing. Diane had also checked the end table that had a secret hidden drawer with a checkbook and cash in it. And when she popped that drawer open, the cash and that checkbook was gone. Diane said it was around $1,000 in cash. Investigators had noted that when they arrived on scene, they did find Cecil's wallet empty, lying outside the apartment in the hallway. Chief Danforth would suggest that Diane, while she was healing, check the house again for this precious jewelry because she had been in so much pain and had gone through so much that maybe she had just simply missed it in her search. Chief Danforth and his team, upon the examination of the Wells bed, was able to determine that the ejected cartridge, the slug, was found in the pillow under Cecil's head. They determined that it was an automatic pistol that was used, but was not found in the apartment during the search. Chief Danforth's investigative team didn't just search the scene, they thoroughly went through that apartment looking for any clues of the weapon used to murder Cecil, going as far as pulling down light fixtures and removing the stove, only to find a large target pistol and a rifle, but not the gun that would have delivered the fatal shot to Cecil. At this time in Alaska, there were no required registration for guns, and Fairbanks was beginning to see more and more small handguns. They carried a heavy punch and now were circulating in town. Investigators felt at this point it was going to be virtually impossible to trace down this weapon, let alone who owned it. The Wells had two apartments essentially rented in this building, and one of the apartment doors is 814. And that's the door that Diane explained that nobody ever uses, so when you came up to the apartments, you saw both doors, but the Wells only used one as their entrance. Door 814 is where they hung the photo that Diane explained was on the floor the previous week when her and Cecil had arrived home from their outing. When officers first arrived at the scene, they also took note that the picture on 814 was still on the door, but it was slightly to the side, like someone pushed it or it swung when someone opened the door. A door that nobody, including Diane, could produce keys for. The main door to the Wells apartment had not been tampered with, so investigators asked Diane how many people had keys to the door. She told them she knew management had one, her and Cecil had one, and then there were maybe two or three other ones out there for family. Diane estimated about 5 keys in total to their main entry door. Diane also couldn't be positive that her and Cecil had locked the door the night when they came home. Within a few days of Diane's release from the hospital, the police investigation and the public, who just days prior was very concerned for her well-being and offering condolences and support, suddenly began focusing on the possibility that Diane was involved in her husband's murder. And this came from rumors that Diane was possibly having an affair with Johnny Warren, a jazz musician that worked at the local club. It would be a few weeks into Chief Danforth's investigation that it would go from seeking the two unknown intruders to the fingers being pointed at Diane and Johnny Warren. Once investigators felt like the affair was more than a rumor, they took a deeper dive into the scene. Chief Danforth would determine that the fatal shot that killed Cecil was done from Diane's side of the bed. Even without having the gun, Chief Danforth would publicly link the gun to Johnny, and at this point, these quiet rumors of Diane and Johnny's affair were in every paper, coast to coast, from Alaska to New York. Overnight, Diane became thrusted even further into the public eye, countrywide, and the press had no qualms with sensationalizing every bit of it. The new narrative of the beautiful wife who had an affair that possibly led to her husband's death? The rumors in the press became too much for Diane to bear, especially all of it around her son, Markham. As she recovered from her injuries, Diane found that she would need to be treated for constant migraines she was suffering from the blows to her head, as well as some facial pain and scarring that wasn't healing the way she expected. Let's talk about Johnny Warren. Johnny Warren was a 33-year-old musician born in Mississippi, December 15, 1919. He was linked to Diane Wells through rumors that Diane had had an affair with Johnny while married to Cecil. Johnny would give the Miner Daily News a statement November 4, 1953. The Miner would add a disclaimer stating that they were not able to print the full statement due to the fact that it would be defamatory towards Miss Diane Wells' reputation, and that Warren, at the time, was not under oath in court when he made these remarks. Johnny would explain that he met Diane, 31 years old, at the country club after a dance last Labor Day. He said that he was playing in the orchestra at the time and that he had been friendly with her since that day. Johnny also stated that he was a gun owner and did carry a gun in Fairbanks because he feared Cecil Wells. Johnny told investigators that he actually had 3 guns. One was a .38 caliber that he carried with him to California. One was a double-barrel pistol that he left in Fairbanks, and the other was a Beretta automatic, which he said that he sold to an unknown person at the Talk of the Town nightclub in the restroom. That piqued investigators' attention since the Beretta pistol was the closest type of weapon that could have been used to kill Cecil Wells. Johnny stated that he was in Oakland, California on October 26, 1953, and he had traveled there with a young woman and his adopted daughter. He adopted Susan Warren, who was 5. Susan's mother was Miss Annette Woods, who worked as a coat check girl who was shot and killed in the Talk of the Town nightclub July 19, 1953. On the night of Cecil's murder, Johnny told investigators that he was working in the country club until around 2 in the morning. He would drive a fellow employee home who lived on 6th Avenue and then drove to pick up the young girl who accompanied him to Oakland. From there, Johnny drove to the North Ward building, the same building Diane and Cecil lived in. He said he stopped at the North Ward building in the morning because there was a man who might accompany him on his way to California. But he was really vague about who this man was and did not name him. He did say this man, who he had met in the lobby, was someone he had worked at the local grocery store before. After they spoke, Johnny then got back in his car and him and the young woman and his adoptive daughter drove to California. It was around 5 a.m. in the morning when they were officially departed from Fairbanks. Oakland police, while having him detained, would give him a lie detector test. However, they said it was not conclusive since their operator giving the test did not have enough information about the murder case to question the suspect adequately. Johnny has denied any involvement in Cecil's murder and claims he doesn't know anybody that would have been involved in his murder. Once it was determined that Johnny was a suspect and had already headed to California, investigators had attempted to stop him at the Canadian border, but by time the Mounties got the message, it was too late. He had already crossed days before. Warren would be picked up by Oakland police October 28, 1953. Johnny would tell the Oakland police officers the last time that he had seen Diane, who he was, quote, friendly with, unquote, it was on her stairwell of the Northward building on Thursday, October 15th at 10 p.m., 2 days before Cecil was murdered. At this time, Oakland had to release Warren since they had no official charges from Fairbanks to hold him. Johnny would agree to sign a statement of the information above for Oakland officers. However, a few days later, more evidence was introduced to the grand jury in Fairbanks, and they brought secret indictments against Johnny as well as Diane. And that's when Fairbanks would reach back out to Oakland police to assist in Johnny's arrest and have him extradited back to Fairbanks. Tuesday, November 3rd, 1953, Diane and her son Markham would be stopped at the Seattle-Tacoma airport when she off-boarded a Pan American airline flight which had left Fairbanks that morning at 10:40 a.m. Federal marshals would greet her as she was deboarding the plane, and Diane and her son were both taken to the local jail. As Diane was walking out with her son after being apprehended by the federal marshals, she was crying and visibly upset. When Diane and her son arrived at King County Jail in Seattle, 4-year-old Markham played happily on the floor, not really understanding what was happening around him. Diane's son was released later that day to the custody of Wally Aiken, the Wells estate attorney in Seattle. Local investigators in Fairbanks knew before Diane boarded the plane on Tuesday that she was leaving, but at the time they didn't have the power to stop her. However, while she was on her flight on the way to Seattle, a grand jury returned secret indictments against Diane Wells and Johnny Warren. That's when the district attorney was able to put in warrants out for their arrest and telegraph those orders to the departments in Seattle and Oakland to assist with their arrest. At 9:30 a.m. Wednesday, November 4th, 1953, Diane was arraigned before the U.S. Commissioner John A. Burns as he read out portions of the secret indictment against her. Diane would be formally charged with first-degree murder of Cecil Wells. Diane would address the charges saying, quote, I previously gave a full statement to proper authorities in Fairbanks and testified before the coroner's jury. I do not wish to make another statement at this time, unquote. Reporters said that Diane was pale-faced and weeping and visibly nervous. December 8, 1953, Diane would leave Fairbanks on bail to Los Angeles to undergo special medical treatment for her migraines. She says she's been suffering horrible headaches since she was beaten by the intruders at the time of her husband's murder. Diane continues to insist that she is innocent of her husband's murder and that the proof of her claim should be in her injuries and her lasting scars as she points to her eyebrows and says, quote, I have to hide the lumps of scar tissue with these long eyebrows. That's where they hit me. I have a lump on my mouth here too, unquote. Diane went on to say, quote, I need medical help to get over the effects of the beating I suffered when my husband was killed. I have headaches now I never had before. I wasn't hurt any place except on my head, not on my body or arms or anything like that, unquote. December 11, 1953, Diane would tell the Nome Nugget, Alaska newspaper when arriving in Los Angeles on Thursday that she was there to rest in a warmer climate before her trial began. Diane said, quote, my husband and I always came here for the winter and the trial won't be until February or March, unquote. Diane again would reiterate that she was innocent and once again deny that her and Johnny Warren, the jazz drummer, ever had a love affair. Diane said, quote, they haven't anything to connect me with the murder except that I was there and beaten up terribly. The worst thing is that I'll be tried on Warren's lies, not on the facts of the case itself, unquote. Wednesday, November 25th, Diane Wells' attorney would file a motion for dismissal of the first-degree murder charge against her, and for the severance and separation of her case from Johnny Warren's case, who is also charged with the murder of her husband. There was another motion filed by Diane's legal team to transfer the trial to a court in another district. The following is part of the affidavit filed in support of the motion to be submitted to the court. It reads as follows. The defendant, Diane Wells, is the young, attractive widow of Cecil M. Wells, a prominent Alaska businessman who is considerably her senior. Since the occurrence of his death, she has been the object of a morbid and sensational journalistic effort to implicate her romantically with the co-defendant, Johnny Warren, who is part Negro, part-time musician. The prejudicial notoriety of this alleged association, which has been promoted and developed with lewd sensational implications by local newspapers, radio news broadcasts, and nationally circulated publications, has caused public opinion to imagine that such an association and friendship did exist. If Diane Wells is forced to stand trial at the same time and place with Warren for the alleged crime, the prejudice already ramped as a result of the implications would be regenerated in the courtroom and in the minds of the jury by the very presence of the defendant jointly charged and standing trial together, unquote. In the motion for dismissal of the murder charges for Diane, her attorney stated that police had insufficient facts they were using to charge her. The motion pointed out that investigators were charging her on murder based on the premise that her and Johnny committed this murder at the same time, stating that Cecil only died of one gunshot wound caused by one trigger being pulled by one person. They also pointed out that the charges against Diane were vague and undefined, and she was unable to enter a plea on that indictment because it does not give her fair notice to all the essential facts of her alleged offense. The motion for dismissal of charges was denied, and the motion for relocation of the hearing was still pending. November 25, 1953, the Nome Nugget reported that U.S. Marshal Francis Worth told Oakland police and reporters that he didn't believe that Johnny pulled the trigger. Worth believes that a third party pulled the trigger and is living in Alaska. Worth said, quote, "I know who he is and he knows I know," unquote. When it comes to Johnny, Worth said, "Johnny is, quote, maybe innocent of the actual shooting, but he is apparently holding back evidence, probably protecting someone else," unquote. Worth went on to say that the murder weapon, which has never been found, is now determined to be an Italian Beretta semi-automatic from Italy that they believe was brought from Italy by a serviceman now living in Monterey, California. Worth said at the time that he knew that Johnny was nervous about heading back to Fairbanks because Johnny said to him, quote, "because there is a lot of feelings against me there," unquote. Johnny said his goal when he arrived in Fairbanks is just to clear his name and he'll help the police in any way he can. As more and more detail would be released to the papers about the investigation and crime scene, this only added fuel to the fire of the media frenzy surrounding the case. Dr. Paul Haglund would release the autopsy and his findings indicating, based on Cecil's food digestion, that he most likely died around 2 a.m. in the morning. However, it wouldn't be until 7 a.m. that Diane would crawl to the neighbor's door asking for help. Police would also report that when they arrived, the apartment was impeccable other than the two broken flower pots on the ground and that there was a pressure cooker covered in blood as well as one of Diane's shoes. Investigators tell local news that they cannot fit the shoe or the pressure cooker into the crime scene because Diane didn't mention it and they didn't understand why those two objects were there because they were so out of place. Basically, they completely dismissed them and omitted them from the scene because they couldn't place them. Throughout time, over and over again, Diane's story of the events that happened that night never changed. Johnny, no matter how many times he was questioned over and over again, would admit to the affair with Diane, even telling the Memphis Press, quote, "Sure, I got mixed up with that woman, but I didn't have nothing to do with killing that man, nothing at all," unquote. Johnny would deny having any involvement with Cecil's murder time and time again. Johnny was open to speaking to all the press. Whether it was newspaper or radio news reporters, Johnny would go into detail about how he met Diane. Johnny told reporters he had been living in Alaska off and on since 1949, and it would be Labor Day 1953 that he says all his big troubles began. At the time, Johnny was working as a grocery store warehouse man during the day, and around 3 to 4 nights a week, he would play as a drummer for the local band that played at the local Fairbanks Country Club. The country club gig was to help him earn extra money. Johnny would say it was the night of September 7th, 1953, when Diane, who was dancing with her husband, glanced over Cecil's shoulder, giving Johnny a flirty eye. Johnny said at first he thought Diane had winked at him. Then later that night, again, she winked at him. The next day, Johnny would decide to call Diane at home. He said he knew exactly who she was without introduction. Everybody in Alaska knew who Diane Wells was. He said they talked on the phone for a few days until Diane invited him over to her apartment for lunch. He said, however, that's not where they would be intimate. In fact, it would be a few more days of lunches before getting intimate. When they did decide to take it to the next step, it would be later at his friend Kenny Wadsworth's place, a guy that played in the band with him at the club. Johnny himself was married to Clara Ann Warren, 30 years old, who was an accountant in Fairbanks. Johnny said October 16th would be the last day that he saw Diane, and he told her that he was heading back to California in the following days because he was having trouble with his wife. He said he was going to California to see his sister. Johnny said on the 17th that night he went to the club like he typically did around 9:30 p.m. He received a call from a man asking if he was the same Johnny Warren who was driving to Oakland the next morning and if he would like a paying passenger. Johnny said he arranged to meet this man at the Northward building in the lobby between 2 a.m. and 4 a.m. Johnny said he did arrive later to the Northward building. He looked around the lobby, but when he arrived, he said, quote, "All I saw was some man in a white coat like a butcher or baker, you know. But he just looked at me and didn't say anything, so I knew he wasn't the man," unquote. Johnny would go on to say that he waited a while, but then he had to get going because he had another passenger that wanted to ride to Oakland, and he had to go pick up his daughter, Susan. Johnny said he picked up his daughter, Susan, and made a bed for her in the back seat of the 1949 Pontiac sedan that he had bought from Cecil Wells' car lot in Fairbanks. Johnny said then the three of them took the Alcan Highway to the States. Johnny told police officers he knows that he was in Northward Building in the lobby between 2 a.m. and 4 a.m., but says he had no clue that upstairs in the apartment that he once had lunch with Diane in, that she was being attacked and her husband was being murdered. In fact, nobody in that building had any idea that this was happening. No neighbors heard anything until Diane crawled down the hallway, pounding on her neighbor's door, yelling for help. After Diane's arrest in Seattle, police state that Diane had used several names before she had married Cecil. They included Diane Walker, Diane Aspel, Diane Aspey, Diane Clark, Diane Monk, and Shelby Diane. Records would also show that Diane was arrested December 19, 1949 in Seattle on first-degree forgery charges in connection with bad checks, but the case was dismissed just 3 days later. That was the extent of her record. The extent of Johnny Warren's record was clean before his arrest in Oakland under the indictment of murder charges of Cecil Wells. It would be discovered by press and investigators that May 26, 1953, Cecil's will would be updated to bequeath all of his assets to his wife Diane and their son Markham, and this discovery would just add fuel to the press coverage. December 3, 1953, bond was granted for Johnny and he was released on a $5,000 bail. For officials, it was the perfect timing because they were having some issues at the federal jail where Johnny was being held, which were causing a lot of concern. Johnny was having issues with another inmate in a small jail who was charged with first-degree murder of Annette Woods, the 32-year-old coat check girl who was shot in the top of the town nightclub last July. His name was Donald Pratt. Police said when they arrested Pratt on the murder of Annette, he muttered a complaint that she had been keeping company with another man. It would be Warren who then adopted Susan, Annette's 5-year-old daughter. Apparently, this was causing quite a commotion in the jail, and they were concerned for both Donald and Johnny's safeties. So when Johnny was released on bond, at least this calmed down that situation. At this point, Diane was out on bond as well, and on December 8, 1953, Diane would book a flight to California with her son, Markham, with her plans to return in the spring for the trial. Up until this point, the motion to dismiss the charges against Diane was denied, and the motion about having the trial moved was still being delayed. Now, due to the fact that they only had an estimated trial date at the time, Diane's plan was to rest and seek medical treatment for her injuries that she was still suffering. It was reported within a few weeks after the inquest that investigators were looking for a third suspect, but at some point they must have dropped either the idea that there was a third suspect involved or just stopped looking for the third person and just solely focused on Diane and Johnny. Diane officially arrived in Los Angeles December 10th and told reporters that she was going to rest in warmer climate before her trial begins in the spring, and that she stands by what she's been saying the whole time, that she is innocent and she is confident she'll be acquitted. Diane again publicly denied the story of her and Johnny and that they had any type of affair. Diane said she will be staying with her friend Joan Mansfield. While Diane was in California, the news coverage didn't stop. Diane was told by her attorney that it was best not to respond to the multiple allegations and report about her and Johnny's alleged affair. While Diane was trying her hardest to distance herself from Johnny and any implications of an affair, Johnny continued to do interviews with papers and radio news all across the country, discussing his and Diane's alleged relations, sharing more and more details with each interview. As consistent as Johnny was about his and Diane's affair, he was just as consistent about Cecil's murder and that him and Diane had no involvement and that he didn't know anyone who might have been involved. Diane was really struggling with all the coverage, especially how it was impacting her son Markham. Bill Colombani, a dance instructor who owned a dance studio in the North Ward building and a good friend of the Wells, would sell his dance studio and move to Los Angeles shortly after Diane arrived in Los Angeles. At this point, the trial was tentatively scheduled for April 5, 1954, and Diane was leaning on her friend Bill for support and friendship. I'm sure having a friendly face that knew her and Cecil and believed her innocence was something that helped her get through the days leading to the trial. At first, when Diane and Markham arrived in Los Angeles, they stayed with her friend Joan. However, in February of 1954, Diane would move her and Markham to the Drake Hotel in Hollywood. Joan had noticed that Diane's mood had shifted dramatically as the time went on. Joan said she checked on Diane constantly and noted that as the days went on, Diane became more and more, quote, despondent, unquote. She said Diane told her she was afraid a conspiracy was being plotted against her. Diane told Joan that they were, quote, out to railroad her into a murder conviction, unquote. Friends of Diane's in Fairbanks, who had also been receiving letters from Diane, also noted in the past few weeks that Diane was becoming more and more despondent as the weeks went on. Joan was so concerned that in the first weeks of March, she would go to the Drake Hotel where Diane had been residing and ask the staff to watch over Diane and check in on her because her friends were concerned about her. On March 8, 1954, Diane would slip out of the Drake Hotel without the staff noticing, and she would check into the Plaza Hotel under the name Doris May. The next morning, the Plaza staff would find Diane lying in her bed, motionless, with a note beside her addressed to Bill. There was an empty bottle of sleeping pills lying next to her, and first responders would declare Diane deceased by suicide. There would be a second note discovered in Diane's room, and the note read, quote, "For one thing, I am guilty to forever seeing Warren. If Warren is guilty, one thing is for sure. Cecil is dead, and I must be the cause of it one way or another," unquote. The note was signed with a large D. Bill would be the one to identify Diane at the police headquarters. He had arrived with Joan, who spoke with investigators about Diane's state of mind since moving from Joan's apartment in Los Angeles to the Drake in Hollywood in February. Bill also told investigators that Diane had threatened suicide many times and that he had taken her sleeping pills away from her before in the past weeks. On the desk next to the bed in Diane's Plaza hotel room lied an incomplete note addressed to Bill. It read, quote, "I had 30 of them, 20 in my bra. I'm happy and relaxed. It's not," unquote. The letter was incomplete. Investigators believe the pills took over as she was writing. The note lying next to her was in an envelope addressed to Bill, and it read, quote, "Thanks for being such a wonderful and loyal friend since my trouble. I mean it, and especially thanks for going out of your way so much for Mark. I won't need this on my last trip. God bless you," unquote. Another note found was addressed to Miss Clara. It read, quote, "Dear Clara, they can say what they wish now, and I can't object, but they would have anyway. I'm deciding this is no worse for Mark than the terrible widespread publicity of this trial, which is sure to crop all of his life. This will be less publicity and over sooner," unquote. She went on to say that she leaves guardianship of Markham up to the Wells family and that Diane and Cecil had wished that in the event of their deaths for Cecil's sister Edna, who was living in Fairbanks, to take custody of Markham, as she's been very devoted to him. Markham would stay in the Los Angeles nursery school until March 10th when Edna was able to arrive to LA and take Markham back to Fairbanks with her. By March 12, 1954, coroners were reporting Diane's death and cause of death as suicide. And though they were still waiting on the toxicology report, they were confident that the cause was the sleeping pills. Markham's custody would come up for a debate between what Diane wanted in her last moments, the Wells family members, and friends of Diane's. The decision was made to look back for any wills by Diane and Cecil and use that to help determine who should have custody of Markham. All of Markham's financial needs would be met by a monthly trust fund payment of $2,000 a month, which today would be equivalent to around $24,000. March 12, 1945, Ted Stevens would also announce that due to Diane's unfortunate and tragic death, that they would be taking Johnny and Diane's trial off the calendar, and that for now, Johnny's trial was postponed until further notice as they were not able to give a possible day and time. The headlines read that Johnny may never be tried for the murder of Cecil Wells. Bill, Diane's good friend, would be charged in 1954 with perjury testimony. Investigators stated that Bill had come to them with false statements about Johnny in hopes to get attention diverted off of Diane. Bill would go to trial and be found guilty in 1955 and would be sentenced to 3 years with suspended time and serve 60 days in the California penitentiary. Johnny would be questioned over and over again throughout the years. He stood firm that he and Diane had had an affair, but they had nothing to do with Cecil's murder. Ultimately, Johnny would never stand trial for Cecil's murder. Time would eventually swallow this case and no resolution was ever sought. Was Diane just another victim, or was she consumed by the guilt in her husband's murder? There's so much more to this case. The amount of news articles related to this case is just overwhelming. And I'm sure there is information out there that is not in the news articles, but I did build this case solely from newspapers because I wanted to report fact and for fact to be the narrator of this case. Thank you again for tuning into another episode. I know this was a long one with a lot of information, so thanks for hanging in there. If you are listening on Apple or Spotify, please make sure to hit that subscribe button and leave a review to help other listeners find these cases. Don't forget, when you see those missing and murdered posts on social media, to hit share, like, and retweet. Every time we share a face, we get closer to solving a case. Until next time.